The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, good afternoon, I should say, and welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in today. One of our favorite guests, Jim Muncy, is with us. Let me run through a couple of quick announcements, and then we'll be off to our discussion. So first, there is no show tomorrow, and this is because we're still encountering some studio setup problems from the move. As those of you that heard the show with two guests on Friday saw that we had some phone line issues. So we're working on that, and there will not be a program tomorrow. The rest of the week is planned out, and you can see all of that on the upcoming show menus and the website newsletter when it's published and the email newsletter when it goes out. Other than that, it's a normal week here on the Space Show, and we thank you for tuning in today. A couple of quick points. You can call us 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener. Let the phone ring and we'll get you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can send us a comment or a question on our blog, which is through our website and the archive page for this particular program. Remember, in addition, that the website newsletter for the coming week, which will be detailed on what's going on, will be uploaded after today's Sunday Space Show program. The email newsletter goes out about 6 a.m. California time Monday morning. If you'd like to have your address added to the list, please send it to me. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download each show. In the upper left menu, remember there's a store under support for those of you interested in logo wear for the Space Show. There is also a listen live button that tells you how to listen to live shows, all the archive show formats, including Alexa with the TuneIn player. So if you have any questions about listening to any of our formatted programs, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please share this information with others who might be interested in listening to the Space Show program. Also remember, center right, the Space Show is a listener-funded project. We are 501c3 with onegiantleapfoundation.org, and your support does keep us on the air, so we do ask you to support us, and your support is really important. If you are a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift because of our 501c3 status. If you're lucky enough to pay California taxes, which have been in the news a lot lately, you get a California tax deduction as well. So you can get more detail about this at onegiantleapfoundation.org or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please also remember we're copyrighted and trademarked. You do have permission to download all of our programs and share them. But please, there are three simple rules. Don't do anything commercial. Don't edit or copy the programs. Don't put them up on any other websites, especially YouTube or anything like that. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. If you do have questions or comments or a specific use in mind for a Space Show program, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's see if we can work something out. And I look forward to hearing from you. In addition to the individual supporters that I mentioned a few seconds ago, we do have sponsors for the Space Show. We have a few sponsorship positions left for 2018. Remember, you get a banner ad that goes across our homepage. You can change it as frequently as you like. You also get a spot read by me on all full-length spatial programs of 60 seconds or less. On shorter spatial programs, I simply acknowledge all of our sponsors and thank them by name. So if you're interested in this program, please email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We only have a couple of sponsorships left for the year. That's because they do eat into the talk time of our guests, so we don't take on too many. But if you're interested, please email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that brings me to the program today. And Jim Muncy has returned, and he is one of our favorite guests. He is the president and founder of Polyspace, which he started 18 years ago. Can you all believe that? In early 2000, as a space policy consultancy to help space entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs succeed at the nexus of space business, technology, and public affairs. Just to make a very impressive bio a little bit shorter, you can read it. It is on our website. Jim co-founded the Space Frontier Foundation in 1998 and served it as chairman of the board for 6 years. 1988. Long time ago. and it's still going gangbusters. And
30 years later.
Yeah, and for those of you that are not on their discussion email thing, blog, or however that works, it has been really, really active lately, and you're missing out on a lot of really good, solid information. Information, I might add, that I use on lots and lots of space show programs. He's a frequent speaker and writer on policy issues. He has a master's in science and space studies from the University of North Dakota Aerospace Science Division. And he has a BA from the University of Virginia, where he was an Eccles Scholar. Again, read his full bio on the website. We are going to talk with Jim rather than read about him. And welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, great, David. How are you?
So we go from what I thought was a banner, amazing year in 2017 to a really strong start for Space 2018. Sort of transition us from 2017 to where we are today.
Well, I mean, who would have thought that commercial space would be the one thing that George W. Bush and Barack Obama and Donald Trump could all agree on? There has been absolutely no let up in the momentum that we were seeing during the last end, sort of the last half of the previous administration, and a tremendous amount of progress being made in 2017. Every company moving forward, doing things, seemingly new remote sensing satellite companies or new Internet of Things satellite companies being set up every day or every week. It's just been incredible. And the pace of change, the pace of advancement, the progress is just incredible. And what I'm enjoying now is that there is really a strong bipartisan level of support for the most important thing that the space industry faces, which is really, can the government keep up with this growth? Can the government keep up with success in the private sector? And by that I mean in almost all space applications, you have to get some sort of a license or permit or some sort of an acknowledgement or confirmation from the federal government that what you're doing is both in space is both consistent with international obligations and treaties and things like that, and U.S. national security, and also in the case of launches and reentries, isn't going to hurt the public. So the federal regulatory structure that was set up, in the case of a space launch in the 1980s and 90s, in the case of telecommunication satellites really dating back to the 70s, 60s and 70s, and remote sensing in the 90s, all of that is just archaic, because almost all of it was based on the assumption that space was going to be done, with the exception of CompSats, rarely, infrequently, expensively, slowly, at a measured pace, that if you had 10 launches of a launch vehicle in a single year, that was really, really, really great. And, of course, SpaceX launched 18 times last year with a Falcon 9, and will be launching probably 30 times this year, a few of which will be Falcon Heavies, but most of which will be Falcon 9s. So, how does the federal government keep up with the paperwork? It's not just a matter of whether or not the federal government is creating a paperwork burden on industry, but can they literally process the things, the applications for a license fast enough that they're not slowing industry down? I have been, I think, blessedly not been spending a lot of time the last year on, fighting with NASA or wondering how, we're going to get NASA to embrace the commercial sector in returning to the moon, which they're starting to do somewhat, but rather focusing on the regulatory environment, because you absolutely have to have the right regulatory environment or industry will grind to a halt, and we can't afford that. We need to have this explosion of progress continue and even accelerate if possible. So that's been a huge challenge. I've been spending a lot of time fighting with the FAA, a lot of time fighting with the Department of Commerce over remote sensing issues. But I see a, thanks to the leadership of the Vice President and the Space Council, a real and also the Congress, including very much Senator Nelson and Democrats in Congress as well as Republicans, focusing on how do we reform regulations, how do we streamline the business environment for the commercial industry so that they can continue to grow and lower costs and oh, by the way, create commercial tools that the federal government that can then use itself to do things in space.
So they're seems to me like they're endorsing commercial space even stronger than they did in 2017.
Oh, I absolutely. I mean, we're going to see a meeting of the Space Council in a couple weeks in Florida that's been announced in the Federal Register, where I believe they're going to unveil a sweeping regulatory agenda for deregulating and streamlining regulation of space activities. But also we're going to see, the first details on the implementation of President's Space Policy Directive 1 on reinserting the moon along the journey to Mars. So, and there's a lot of talk about how that's going to be done with commercial as well as international partners. So, that obviously needs to get discussed and fleshed out, but there's so much progress, frankly, in our industry. There's now so many examples of problems cropping up and getting solved in a couple months or a few months or at most 6 months. Whereas when the government program has a hiccup, it can be a year or more before they can move forward. It's not that the government isn't smart, it's that the government has different reward systems than the private sector does. The most important of which is in the private sector, time is money. And it's your own money. And in the government, that's not the case. Time is still money in the federal government, but money doesn't matter as much in the federal government. So, we who are taxpayers would like to think it matters, but, people aren't being graded based on that.
It is so bullish what you're talking about. Is there a downside any place out there or a choke spot that is really serious where so far solutions don't exist?
I think there are challenges. There's you know, figuring out how to do some of these things in a much more simple and streamlined fashion. And when I say these things, I mean the goal of authorizing and supervising commercial space activities, which the federal government is required to do under the Outer Space Treaty. You know, I'd like to say that all commercial space activities are already authorized by the Declaration of Independence, because we have the right to pursue happiness, and we can do that in space too. There's no limits. But the government does have to set up a system for making sure that what a commercial space venture does doesn't violate international law. So they have to do that supervision thing, and that takes a little time and a little paperwork. And there's also a need to figure out how to create rules that are performance-based. In other words, rules that tell you what result you need to deliver in terms of public safety, rather than tell you how to do it, which is what most of the existing launch regulations do. They're based on, in many ways, how things were done in the 1960s or even 50s to prevent, you know, for example, you know, the clearest example is a national range includes a range safety officer with a range destruct button to blow up the rocket if it's going off course. Okay, well, reusable launch vehicles aren't going to have, you know, range destruct packages on them because they don't want to blow up their launch vehicles. What they want to do is perhaps have a thrust termination system or backup software that allows them to change direction or something like that, and possibly recover the launch vehicle, maybe not with a landing, but with a recover it from a crash and figure out what went wrong if they can. But we're getting away from this sort of old ICBM based, do it exactly this way and you'll be safe, with all of these backups in place, to a totally new approach of, using standard processes to design to be safe and then have some backups to deliver actual safety. Remember, we're really, you know, some people like to say that the launch business has been around for 50 years, and there's no question there have been industry-developed launch vehicles since the 50s, because industry was working for the government developing ICBMs, but we've only really had totally privately funded launch vehicles, depending on your definition, since the late 80s, when General Dynamics took the Atlas Centaur and made it commercial and privately committed to build 18 of them and sell them, which was a huge risk by General Dynamics at the time, or whether it's, you know, Elon and Jeff Bezos and others investing in a range of heavy reusables to small launch vehicles like Vector or Virgin Orbit or whatever. So we're really figuring out what's safe. We're really figuring out what's the most reliable approach and what the best technologies approaches are. And we're figuring that out in the marketplace, which is where we should figure it out. So it's kind of exciting. I mean, if you'd asked me a couple years ago, maybe last year, but if you'd asked me a couple years ago, was I absolutely certain that New Space was going to work, I would say no. Well, now I would answer that question yes. Now I would tell the listeners that I don't think this can stop. I think there's too many examples of success that even if a major leader in the new space field falters or fails, I don't think that's going to stop it. I think it's just too exciting, too natural, too dynamic, and hopefully that profitable that it's just going to continue. And so far, the investors seem to agree and are investing money in our industry, and certainly results are being produced that totally exceed what is done by the traditional paradigm.
You have your first email question. Is Bob is in Des Moines, and he says, was the success on the industry of the Falcon Heavy launch discounted and taken for granted, or has it had a profound effect from what you can tell?
Well, I think it had a profound effect on the country. I think that in many ways, for the first time since perhaps the iconic first launch of the shuttle or a few other launches like that, perhaps, you know, right after the Challenger accident, you know, when it launched again in 1988, or certainly going back to Apollo, you had the whole country kind of participating vicariously in a space launch. And, you know, we don't all do it clustered around watching black and white TVs anymore. We do it on YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and you know, I don't know how many people watched it live. I know a lot of people did, but you know, people all over the planet watched it in one way or another, and just thought it was the coolest thing they ever saw. And that's a the political impact of that has not yet manifest. It has not yet been felt. I mean, it's being felt, but I don't know how long it will take. But it's really hard for politicians who don't like Elon or SpaceX because they're arrogant or because they're upstarts or because they're threatening the contract dollars and programs of the old industry. It's you know, it's hard to stand in the way of obvious progress. And the, you know, the arguments for continuing to do things, or certainly continuing to start programs in the old way when there are demonstrations of success like this, will get, you know, they'll just get sillier and sillier. So I don't think we've seen the full effect yet, but I think that when the vice president's chief of staff tweets out before the launch that it's going to make a huge, you know, difference, that's kind of cool. And I think you're going to see more events like that from more companies as, you know, this decade can concludes over the next couple of years, and it's going to be unstoppable.
You have another email from our friend Dr. Doug in Southern California. Do you hear anyone in Washington talking about using the Falcon Heavy as a primary launcher to the moon, or is it primarily SLS, Deep Space Gateway, and then someone else's lander?
Well, depending on. On what you mean by that, NASA is already saying that they plan to launch astronauts to the Deep Space Gateway on Orion with SLS, but that all of the resupply and servicing and other cargo needed by the deep and even elements of the Deep Space Gateway will be launched commercially. And NASA said that they want to take some of the ISS cargo launches that are currently dedicated to ISS and have those companies turn around and see what they can do in terms of delivering cargo to cislunar space. Not necessarily with the same spacecraft, but possibly, okay? And so NASA is already saying that there will be many commercial launches to cislunar space, and given that we know that the cadence of Orion launches on SLS to deep space is at best going to get to one a year or so, I would say there will probably be more commercial launches to deep space for NASA than there will be federal government launches, perhaps even by total mass. I don't know. Now, obviously, we have to figure all that out. We have to figure out what are we going to have this deep space gateway? I mean, in the budget document that was leaked a few weeks ago, where OMB tells the agency what they're going to put in their final budget for the president that's being released this coming week, you know, there was language about the first element of the deep space gateway actually being launched commercially and launched to whatever orbit around the moon or near the moon commercially. That's a big deal. That means that, you know, the federal government believes that commercial launch is reliable enough and certainly affordable enough to use it to even launch key elements of their architecture and their infrastructure commercially and not just on SLS. But the reality is that SLS is so late and will be launched so infrequently that they need to. So, you know, the question is at what point does everyone just sort of agree that between New Glenn and Vulcan and Falcon Heavy or even BFR, you're not going to need to continue SLS because the private sector has responded to the desire to have a larger launch capacity and just develop something that delivered the goods. But, you know, no one's running around attacking SLS right now because why bother? I mean, all it's going to do is irritate the people who support SLS and make them even antsier and more spun up about the fact that Elon is launching and other people are launching and that, you know, let's just say their grave is already dug. So, you know, we'll see. And I'm sure I'll get in trouble for saying that, but I don't care.
Do you think it's going to end up being canceled down the road?
I don't think it's sustainable down the road, so by definition it will eventually be terminated or canceled or torqued into something else or something. You know, I think the really smart engineers at the Marshall Space Flight Center should be designing spaceships. Ships that fly in space and never fly to the Earth or from the Earth. They're built in space that fly in space. You can call them Aldrin cyclers. You can call them spaceships. You can, you know, whatever. But, you know, we ought to be figuring out how to do large-scale human migration to celestial bodies. And they ought to be thinking about that. And not trying to figure out how to launch 70 metric tons when a company has just launched 63 metric tons. So,
you have another email. And listeners, hopefully you'll switch over to the phones, 1-866-687-7223. Paul is in Boston, and he says, I read different media around the country, both online and in print, and I have seen a fair number of articles with people criticizing SpaceX and Musk. Not everybody was supportive of this launch. I'm wondering, since these articles are appearing in credible and sometimes prestigious papers or journals or online sources, do they have any tracks to influence policymakers, or is it just the thoughts of journalists here and there that don't like what was going on with SpaceX?
Okay, so look, there's, first of all, there you know, we have 320 million people in this country. So, you know, obviously there will be a lot of different opinions about everything.
Correct.
You know, there are people, mostly but not entirely on the political left, who think that billionaires spending their own money to launch a car to space is just wrong, because it's a waste of money, and even if it's your own money, and even if you earned it in the commercial marketplace, you shouldn't be allowed to do things like that. So, you know, there is no, you know, universal acclaim and support for even the most obviously cool thing in the world. That said, you know, there's a commentator on Forbes who's not in published in Forbes magazine, but published on their as part of their online opinion writers, and they have a bunch of these online opinion writers. And this particular gentleman's name is Lauren Thompson, and he runs a pro-defense lobbying organization in Washington, which is great. I'm totally for defense and national security. But of course he gets a lot of funding from Boeing and Lockheed. And so he's taken it upon himself to be an ongoing critic of SpaceX. You know, that after the launch of the Northrop Grumman-built Zuma satellite a month ago, when it didn't appear like the satellite actually showed up in orbit where it was supposed to, about which I know nothing, by the way, you know, he proceeded to write a somewhat snarky op-ed, you know, arguing that SpaceX wasn't successful, and this is why, you know, you have to be careful with going with cheaper commercial approaches, and you have to still do the tried and true government contractor approach sometimes. And a congressman who happens to represent Huntsville, Alabama, read from that column at a congressional hearing. Now, the congressman didn't disclose that this was an online column, not a printed column. He didn't disclose that the person writing the column was being paid by Boeing and Lockheed. In fact, had a disclosure of that in the op-ed. Didn't read the disclosure, just read the nasty comments about Elon to argue that, and this was at a hearing on commercial crew. So, you know, his point was, we can't trust to ever launch astronauts on these rockets because obviously they're unsafe and unreliable, and we shouldn't. Now, it turns out that all of the research and development, or the research in using the ISS, is all based in Huntsville. And the most important thing we can do for the research is to get more astronauts up there. And I don't just mean astronauts using U.S. rockets instead of Russian rockets, but by having U.S. commercial crew vehicles, we'll be able to expand the crew of ISS to 7 or 8. And all those additional slots, because we bring them there, will be American slots. So we'll be able to double or triple the amount of research time we conduct at the ISS. Most people don't understand that, you know, the first X number of astronauts you launch to the ISS are basically, their time is consumed with operating the ISS and maintaining it as a facility. But with 6 people on crew, as you add people, you know, almost all of their time is available for utilization. So that's really cool. And that's an incredibly, you know, productive investment we could make. So here was this congressman from Huntsville, you know, kind of idiotically quoting a hack out in industry, representing a particular part of industry, attacking Elon for something that Elon didn't do, or that SpaceX didn't do, which was fail to dispense a satellite, because the dispenser was built by Northrop Grumman. So that's the sort of thing we have to deal with. And is it a fair or a legitimate attack? No, of course not. But hopefully, as we continue to succeed on many fronts with many vehicles and many companies, that resistance and that opposition will, you know, slowly yield to the common sense of reality. It won't be easy. I mean, the biggest challenge, frankly, is going to be how do you force the government to rethink how it does things in space to maximize the utilization of commercial suppliers? That's a really big challenge because the government likes to do things the way they do it. And if they have a standard approach for doing it, then they don't see any reason to change. I mean, if you are in the business of gathering environmental data at the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and you work with NASA to design these very large platforms with lots of sensors that gather environmental information as part of the Earth Observing System, then why would you want to buy data from Planet? Even though Planet has hundreds of satellites up there and literally gets daily visits of any place on the globe and can get you a tremendous amount of data incredibly affordably in ways that you can synthesize and start answering questions you couldn't before with a 14-day or 18-day revisit time from a major Battlestar Galactica platform that's the more typical environmental satellite we have. So, you know, how do you get those people to start thinking about using the tools that they have will have at their disposal as opposed to just doing things the way they've always done it? Ultimately, budgets will force them to change, but it would be really nice if they embraced the paradigm shift sooner.
You have another follow-up question from Doug again in Southern California, and let me pull it up here. Who do you think will be developing the full-size, i.e. eventually human-rated, lunar lander, commercial or international? And when a lunar lander is developed, why can't a commercial vehicle just hand off a cargo or crew module directly to the reusable lunar lander? Why does one need to go to a deep space gateway instead of the two vehicles just rendezvousing and handing over modules?
So I'm going to stick with generalities here because I represent some companies that are engaged in this stuff, but I also don't know all of the technical details of this. First of all, thank goodness you said reusable lander, because there may be people who think that we're going to have an expendable lander again, which would, of course, be dumber than dirt. In this case, dumber than moon dirt. Although moon dirt's pretty sharp, so who knows. As far as the logistics of Earth to lunar surface transportation, I think that it makes sense to refuel spacecraft to have a greater capacity to take stuff back and forth. So it may turn out that there are natural staging points along the way that allow for refueling, or could also allow for cargo transfer between ships. I don't know whether those should be at low lunar orbit or L1 or L2. NASA has been talking about a distant retrograde orbit in the vicinity of L2 because they wanted to have an orbit that was very easy to get into from Earth, Earth orbit. And there's some arcana about that I don't understand, and to the extent I do understand them, I think it's stupid. But I'm going to leave this to the engineers. Ultimately, though, I really would like it to be an economic decision. I would not like it to be a decision left to engineers to figure out what's the easiest thing for them to engineer. I would like us to sort of think about it from a more strategic perspective of what's going to be the most economical not necessarily over the long term, but over the midterm, over the next 20 years or so. And if there's a good place to do that, if we need a gateway to enable that, fine. Because there's going to be a need for people to be involved, fine. If there isn't, then it can be done robotically, whatever. I'm not going to decree. The reality is that the Deep Space Gateway exists as a concept because we needed to have a place for Orion to go, because NASA's program of record will never be able to afford a lander, ever, in the current budget run out. The only way you're going to be able to afford to land large amounts of stuff, let alone people, is with some sort of partnership, preferably a commercial partnership, and because internationally, countries have said they're interested in working on that, but not many of them, with the exception of the Japanese, have really demonstrated significant capabilities towards that. Now, the Augustine Commission back in 2009 actually laid out perhaps the right paradigm for this, which was, if you're going to start initially with an expendable lander approach or a semi-expendable lander approach, where maybe you have cheaper, dumber landers that are developed by the commercial sector, and then a reusable ascent stage that's also an escape module that could be done by a more traditional government contractor, possibly with international content, then that ascent module could be reused. But the key point was, take the risk with a cheaper descent module that can be done commercially, because the government, the more reliable ascent module can also get you out of a bad situation in an emergency. Since it's got to be designed to get from the surface of the moon up to Orion or Deep Space Gateway or whatever anyways, just use it as an escape path if there's a problem with the lander going down. So Augustine called for a hybrid approach, you know, 9 years ago. So I see no reason why we couldn't, you know, that should be our starting position as far as how we do landers. At the same time, you're going to have commercial companies doing small landers and eventually larger cargo landers, like Blue Origin has approached. I mean, obviously Moon Express has a small lander that they've developed and tested and are ready to finalize based on their launch vehicle performance. And then Astrobotic's been working on a lander for several years. You know, as I mentioned, Blue already and Blue Moon. I'm sure that Elon's team could come up with a lunar lander if they were given the opportunity to partner with NASA to go do one. You know, ultimately, I think you may see a traditional NASA / international lander overtaken by events, depending on how much partnership dollar, how many partnership dollars NASA puts up for working with the commercial side. And that's important because I think we're going to need to have a variety of ways of getting different size things to the surface of the moon. And some of those smaller systems can grow up to be bigger systems. And certainly the technologies and the approaches we use in them can be translated to eventually reusable landers. ULA has been working on a really great innovative lander concept with Maston Space Systems called Ceres. Called Zeus, which is based on a Centaur or an ASIS upper stage, but then it's a dual thrust axis lander, and it's totally reusable because you can refuel it on the surface.
What do you, so public-private partnerships seem to be the way of the future, and where does the international market fit into this? Are they going to have sort of an equal standing with public-private partnerships, or they're going to come down the line?
That's a really great question. I mean, first of all, you know, we ought to be encouraging collaborations between U.S. companies and foreign companies, certainly from allied nations. In other words, there ought to be ways for, you know, the Italian space contractors, who used to be called Alenia and now are part of some different conglomerate, I don't remember their name, and Mitsubishi in Japan and others can work together on projects with sponsorship perhaps from their respective governments. So we ought to be looking for ways to have more sort of cross-national commercial partnerships as well. We shouldn't just have government-to-government partnerships. But beyond that, it all depends on what do countries bring to the table. I don't think Russia, for example, is going to have a full partnership role going forward because I don't see them as actually sponsoring a significant amount of activity as part of a lunar campaign or lunar development effort because they have no money. And that's not true. They have money, but they don't have money for space. So the question is going to be what can they play a role as a contractor? Which is a valuable and useful contribution to make, but I don't think they're as dynamically present and state of the art as the industry is in other countries, and that's unfortunate. But that's where we are. So now NASA tends to like to have international partnerships, in part because that makes it harder to kill programs, because we've made promises to other countries to be part of a joint effort, and that tends to keep the program sold and keep it going, even when budget hiccups and technical problems crop up, as they always do, and things are slowed down, and Congress is suspicious of why it's taking so long to deliver the intended result. You know, the international partnership, you know, backs you up. It's not clear to me that international partnerships save money. You know, people talk about the fact that, oh, well, if the international community could fund a lunar lander, then that would meet a functional gap in the U.S. portfolio, and that would be great. Well, yes, if they could do it by themselves, that would be great. But the reality is they will want our help, which costs us money, and it will take a while for them to be able to develop it, even with our help and our money. And it might be faster to do that either commercially or to make other changes in our architecture that would free up resources to do a lander. So, you know, I am all for international partnerships. I think it is vitally important that the United States make available opportunities to freedom-loving nations to work with us in space, because we know China is going to let them try to create opportunities for them to work with the Chinese. And I think we want English spoken as well as Mandarin on the high frontier.
You have a caller. You ready?
Well, I'm ready. I'm excited.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah, so we were talking about international efforts. Now, what is our current status on getting a service module for the Orion? I thought the ESA was supposed to be doing this, or...
They are.
How's that coming along?
And it's taken longer than it was supposed to. They had some delays and problems. I believe I don't know if it's been, I'm sorry, I'm not tracking the program in detail, I believe the service module is supposed to be shipped to the U.S. If it hasn't been shipped already, it will be shipped to the U.S. Sometime this year for testing and integration into the first Orion capsule for launch late 2019, early 2020. So they have developed it. It was based on a lot of the technologies and subsystems in the automated transfer vehicle, cargo vehicle, that ESA had funded the development of for ISS. And, you know, it's my understanding that I think they've committed to build a second service module for the second Orion. I don't know where things are beyond that. They absolutely are doing that. I believe that it's, if not already finished manufacture, it will very soon be, and will be shipped to the U.S. for additional testing and then integration into Orion. So I think that's working out, broadly speaking.
Then that is happening then.
That is happening. And the U.S., NASA allowed the Europeans to do that as a way of meeting their utilization commitment, their utilization charges for ISS. In other words, they could, instead of continuing to provide automated transfer vehicles to deliver cargo to ISS, they were going to be allowed to develop the service model for Orion and be part of the Orion program, so they would actually be part of a human spaceflight program for the first time, really, as part of building a crewed vehicle. Obviously not the crewed part, the service module part, but it's still a very important thing for them to do because the astronauts are depending on that service module to work when it gets into lunar orbit to fire its engine and bring the astronauts back to Earth. So it's been a great accomplishment for the Europeans. I'm sure they'll make it will be made to work, and hopefully we'll see it fly in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So then it looks like NASA's program is moving toward the ability to basically orbit the moon and return.
Right. And that's the only thing that they could ever do, short of a huge infusion of new money. I mean, the numbers haven't changed since the Augustine Committee looked at this in 2009. And you can't develop a new launch vehicle and a new crewed spacecraft and a lander at the same time, because you add up those development curves and they all add up. And the mountain peak gets really big, way far above any likely aggregate budget that NASA is going to have. If you go back and look at the Augustine report, it's still online at NASA headquarters. There's a chart, you know, somewhere in the back that talks about the flexible path and why they chose that. Because the reason the flexible path works budgetarily, it didn't say that you would never go to the moon. That was Obama's thing, okay? The flexible path simply said you would go to interesting places like libration points and Lagrange points and other places, and even go look for asteroids that have been trapped in lunar orbit, you know, Earth in the Earth-Moon orbit itself. So small asteroids you could go look at. But that you wouldn't start working on a lander until the launch vehicle was fully developed and until Orion was fully developed and tested. And then you would actually have development dollars available for a lander. That was the idea. And it's basic arithmetic. It's not rocket science. Now, if we had chosen to not use $2 billion a year to develop a government launch vehicle, you would have been able to use existing commercial launch vehicles and, you know, slightly enhanced versions of them that could have been possible easily with a partnership, launch pieces of exploration missions into Earth orbit, tie them together, refuel them in orbit, and send them on their way to the moon, and you would have had a much faster cadence of missions because you weren't waiting for a launch vehicle. You could focus your resources on the spacecraft. You could focus your resources on partnerships for commercial launch vehicles, and then most of your money would be to start developing a lander, and it would have been gone much faster. Instead, what we did was we spent just enough money to keep a crewed vehicle program alive, just enough money to, you know, keep a launch vehicle alive, although probably a little bit more, and no money for landers and no money for refueling or any important technologies like that. That's where we went, okay? We went that way partly because Congress told them to, and partly because industry told Congress to tell them to. So that was the approach that kept all the shuttle contractors going, and that's what they did.
Yeah,
so,
but part of this was predicated on the anti-moon position of Obama. I mean, Obama had the funding at the time to fully fund the program, but he was not for it, and because they were spending money just massively increasing spending at that time. Another few billion wouldn't have hurt, but of course he did his anti-space. In my opinion,
he absolutely wasn't going to spend a lot more money on space. Okay, and his
if he'd have wanted to have done it, I think if he'd have asked for it, they would have done it. But the problem was they had the Congress, they had 60 votes in the Senate. He was like a hero to the Democrats at the time.
He could have
done it.
Absolutely, but they came in, they knew that. Remember, at the tail end of the Bush administration, the NASA administrator was attacking the president and attacking the White House for not giving them enough money. Okay?
Yeah. Oh, sure.
In other words, under the amount of money that Bush was giving them, and it wasn't like you were going to suddenly have Obama give them more money for Bush's program.
But the thing is that they were big for big stimulus. They could have thrown a few billion more, and nobody missed it at the time.
I understand completely, and they proposed more. For example, they proposed more funding for commercial crew right off the bat. Imagine how much further along we would have been if all that money had actually gone to commercial crew, as was proposed. But there were people who did not want that in Congress, who did not want that money to go to commercial crew. They wanted it to go to the program of record, which I understand, but that also slowed us down in developing a U.S. capacity to launch astronauts again. I mean,
it's
2004 that the shuttle wasn't going to fly at some point, okay? So it's not like we shouldn't have actually invested in 2009 in as much as possible in having a commercial option for launching astronauts to low Earth orbit, but we didn't. We put more money into Ares 1, okay, which was stupid in the first place. So,
I'm not saying that what's been done is the right way to go. I'm just pointing out the massive opportunity to do that was lost.
There was an opportunity to double down on Constellation and throw more money at it, but that they weren't going to do that. Neither the space advisors to Obama nor Obama's spending priorities were inclined in that direction, so that's for sure. Obama did come up with new resources for new programs at NASA. Congress didn't totally like that, you know, and so we ended up with Constellation Light, which is what we have now. And it's sort of like this rob Peter to pay Paul situation where we're all just sort of struggling along with just enough resources to do something. Commercial crew has taken longer. Obviously, SLS and Orion have taken a lot longer. I mean, remember, the Orion program is 13 years old, okay? Lockheed Martin, over 12 years old now. Lockheed Martin was awarded the Orion contract in the fall of 2005. So, why has it taken that long? Well, a lot of reasons. Adding the Europeans and the service module was a big part. But which ostensibly was supposed to save us money because, after all, they would be building and contributing the service model. So we wouldn't have to pay Lockheed Martin to do that. But Lockheed Martin had already designed a service module. Lockheed Martin knew how to build it, okay? So the money we spent helping the Europeans do a service module really just slowed us down. And we had to wait for them to be able to deliver a service module. So, you know, we are where we are. We shouldn't have had to do it this way. Other options should have been pursued. And what else is new?
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not saying it, but remember, a lot of things have turned out to be the case. At least wasn't. I mean, the success of SpaceX in 2009 and 10 wasn't transparent to me that they'd be where they are today. Either.
Absolutely, absolutely. But what happened?
If you'd have known that for sure, you might have had a different thought. But you know,
in 2010, the Falcon 9 did work. Okay,
yeah.
It did have a successful launch of Dragon. Okay, on its first mission for NASA, and. The Falcon 9 had been launched before that. And so there were some signs that SpaceX would work out, at least to some extent. And a lot of us had the basic belief that the motivations of the private sector, when married with the motivations and goals of the public sector, could work together and produce more results for less money and do so faster. And I think that's been proven out over time. And those of us who were doing it, if you want to argue on faith, that's fine, but that faith has been justified over time. Whereas, you know, we have lots of historical data about cost-plus government contractor programs failing. Usually because either there's too much money, there's not enough money, or the technology isn't quite there, or some other bureaucratic reason, which ends up leading to some NASA administrator or some president or some Congress deciding to change direction because the current direction isn't working out. I mean, remember, the program that NASA was pursuing before Constellation was an attempt to develop reusable launch vehicles, as what was called the Space Launch Initiative. And then they took out of that just building a reusable capsule or spacecraft called a crew transfer vehicle that would use existing, heavy expendables. It was called the Orbital Space Plane. And then that morphed into Orion under Griffin when he came in. So my point here is that, you know, the technology obviously advances, but the fundamental technical arguments don't change. What changes is where are we trying to invest the money and are we attempting to bring new resources to bear from the private sector and the motivations of the private sector to move faster and be more creative and take risks that the public sector often doesn't want to take. Can we bring those to bear on solving the challenges of spaceflight? And I think going beyond SpaceX now, we can say that that works.
Well, I think at this point, the SpaceX is doing very well, I think, at this point. Like I said, it wasn't clear to me in 2009 or 10 it would work out as well as it has.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right.
The other thing
right.
is I felt that I'm not sure if Congress hadn't stepped in just how far the administration was going to go. I thought they were basically trying to shunt most of the space money into kind of a university research kind of thing, plus the unmanned probe stuff and of course climate and that sort of thing, and just basically gradually kill off human spaceflight in increments while pretending to go commercial.
Okay,
I may have been wrong, but that's what I thought they were up to.
I can speak somewhat authoritatively. I was kind of the token Republican advocate for Obama space. And I was privy to a lot of discussions and decisions that were made leading up to the FY 2011 budget rollout, which was, of course, a failure by any tactical standards of how you roll out a budget. It was largely a failure because, frankly, NASA had two different heads. It had two different brains. It had a brain that was driving it towards the traditional NASA approach, and it had a brain of someone who was very pro-space and also pro-commercial, but and also pro-science, but very pro-commercial, excuse me, very pro-human spaceflight, and that was the deputy administrator, Lori Garver. And the administration attempted to set a new course that over time would have delivered a lot more human spaceflight. Obama came to the Kennedy Space Center and talked about people living and working in space forever. In other words, over the long term, essentially space settlement. Presidents hadn't talked like that before. And so it was, I thought, in many ways, a step forward. Was it done right? Was it managed well? Did we have the right number one at NASA? No. And there are lots of other ways in which it failed. But I can tell you that the intent of a lot of the people involved in it was very much pro-space and pro-human spaceflight. What it wasn't pro was traditional cost-plus contracting and continuing Constellation. That it was against. I absolutely grant you that. But I think we've learned now that giving money to traditional contractors under traditional contractual arrangements is not necessarily synonymous with progress in human spaceflight.
Well, I think it's less the problem of contractors than it is with the government, though, and that probably means Congress and presidents and at that level of government.
Well, I'm not picking on the contractors.
I mean, if they were given a real commitment, I think they could
do it. Very hard, and they produce great hardware. I think the system that they're operating in with the government absolutely rewards failure instead of success, because they're paid for their time and their expenditures. They're not paid for results. If the spacecraft works or the spacecraft comes in early, they don't get paid more money. They can actually get paid less. So, I mean, that's perverse, but that's where we are. And so if you want to say that that's part of the government and therefore it's the government's fault, I agree with you. What I don't agree is that it's always the politician's fault. It often is the politician's fault, but it's really more the system. I was up at Brown University yesterday and I gave a speech, and I've said this before, but I really kind of, you know, I guess I thought about it a little bit when I was, you know, standing up there in front of these kids. The problem, more than anything else, is that we aren't judging NASA with the right measuring stick. We aren't grading them on what we should be grading them on. Okay? If I could wave a magic wand, we would grade NASA on how many people flew in space that year, on how many person hours of research and utilization time was going on at ISS, on how many people were at various delta V values from low Earth orbit. Okay, in other words, the further out you are, the more you would get credit for it. Just because it's beneficial to have more people in space than fewer people in space, because presumably they're going to be doing something, they're going to be economically motivated to do something productive while they're there. So, I mean, if we could come up with some basic metrics like that and reward NASA for actual progress in spaceflight rather than failing to kill astronauts or failing to blow up rockets. Because the best way to not blow up a rocket is to never launch one. And I just think that we should really give NASA. It's not NASA's fault that they are the way they are and they are where they are. It's that we're not grading them by the right metrics. And if we could grade NASA by better metrics, if NASA were actually rewarded for getting America into space, I think we would see them get us into space. But they're not. They're not being rewarded for getting us into space. And ultimately, that's a reflection of the fact that most people in Congress don't really care whether or not we're getting into space. A lot of people in Congress care about whether or not we're spending enough money in certain congressional districts. And
what they tend to do.
And I understand that. But since at least some of us are paying our taxes so that we get into space, I would like to see us get into space. It's a crazy idea I have. It's a crazy dream.
Well, against that, I mean,
John, you gotta wind it up, John. I've got other people who want to get in on.
Okay, I'll get off and let
thank
somebody
you, John,
else.
I really appreciate you calling in.
All right, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, thank you, John. Listeners, the line is available if you want to get in and give us a call. It is 1-866-687-7223. Jim, I've got an email I'm going to read, and hopefully some of these people who have been emailing me saying they want the line will start calling in. Beth is in Seattle, and Beth says, to what degree do we need a solid, non-inflationary, healthy economy to pursue our commercial space as well as space exploration dreams and concepts? We're hearing now of possible economic problems. Is our space program at risk and commercial investment at risk?
Okay, so first of all, I would say that I don't believe that the economy is in trouble at all. I believe that, in fact, some economic performance numbers are so good that, and of course the run-up in the stock market has been so substantial that, one, a correction was called for, and two, there's a belief that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates. So, but corporate profits and investment and employment and everything is going up, you know, like crazy. And I don't think we've even seen, frankly, you know, 5% or 10% of the effects of the tax bill that was passed by Congress last year. So I think the economy is generally very good. Now, your question is absolutely valid. But I would argue that space is valued differently based on what its thrust is. If space is a government program that we conduct because we're a wealthy nation, because we're a great nation, and we want to go do cool things because we can do that, then it really helps to have a vibrant economy that's growing and there's plenty of resources for doing anything we want to do. If the economy's not doing so well, then there will be a lot of arguments about our not having those resources, and therefore we can't spend as much money on space as we'd like. If, on the other hand, space is seen as a frontier, and in particular an economic frontier, where we can go create new jobs and create new industries and become more prosperous, I would hope that the notion of co-investing in public-private partnerships in space would seem like a good idea, especially if things aren't so well economically. In other words, not only do you not have enough federal dollars to do it the traditional way, but you have the dual motivation of not just co-investing with the private sector in commercial space when you have to be more frugal, but you also have the benefit of potentially stimulating new economic activity, which would in fact grow and create more resources for the country. So, you know, I think it's absolutely valid to ask how is the economy doing and will that have an impact on our progress in space? It will. I happen to think our economy is doing pretty well. I I do believe that generally the public thinks the economy is not only doing well, but is going to continue to do better. And the businessmen and investors think that. And therefore, they're willing to invest and try things. And space is one of the new sexy things for people to invest in. So I think, I mean, no situation is perfect, but I think we're in a pretty good situation for continued private as well as public investment in space. And what we just need to do is continue to adopt this new paradigm as much as possible. So that's a great question, Beth. I appreciate it.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall. I'm down in Yukon at my daughter's house.
Okay, go for it, Marshall.
Elon Musk was talking about taking his Dragon module and going around the moon with a couple of independent people.
Yeah.
Would that basically put a pretty big nail in the coffin of SLS and the Orion?
Well, I believe SpaceX has since announced that they're no longer pursuing that mission. So I don't think that's on the active plan anytime soon. I would have to, since I work for SpaceX, I would not want to speculate on why they made that decision. I don't know why they made that decision. I absolutely believe that there will be opportunities for SpaceX to launch people on Dragon V2, around the moon or into lunar vicinity, as part of public-private partnerships going forward with NASA and industry in developing the moon. So I think that's going to happen. I just don't know that it's going to happen anytime soon. And it's not Elon. I can tell you this. It is not Elon's desire to kill or to embarrass or to or in any way to denigrate the traditional space program. Mm. What he would like to do is work with NASA to do more and pursue more goals, more aggressive goals, perhaps even faster than the traditional program is doing it. But he's not attacking SLS or Orion or anything like that.
Yeah, well, he's totally independent. I agree with that. The next thing is I was terribly impressed with the Heavy launch, and the key thing there is what kind of paradigm shifts are in the works due to the fact that the cost of getting literally tonnage into space has been dropped?
That is a wonderful question. That is a wonderful question. This is something people don't really think about. We've had this belief that launching a kilogram into space is necessarily so expensive and necessarily so precious that we have designed these satellites that are incredibly flimsy, incredibly light, incredibly high-tech, and incredibly expensive. Well, what happens if you could just launch a... I'm going to be somewhat silly here, but launch a satellite made of cinder blocks, okay? Now, you would never build a satellite of cinder blocks, but my point is if it's cheaper to launch mass suddenly, ideally you should see some adjustment in the mass of satellites would lead to lower cost of satellites.
And the fact that you do less origami to get it all fit in the nose capsule.
Right, exactly. So that's exactly the sort of, economists call this demand creation. When a new capability enters the marketplace that, and, or at a price performance level that's different than has been seen before, suddenly people start thinking, well, what could I do with that?
Exactly.
Okay? And if you make communication satellites, well, you know, originally the Falcon Heavy, its job was to launch large communications satellites to GEO. But Jiminy Christmas, SpaceX just kept improving the Merlin's performance. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, did the last-minute fueling to super cool the propellants, the liquid oxygen, and densify the liquid oxygen, so that the performance of the Falcon 9 itself just got better. And now you'll be able to launch most commercial communication satellites to geostationary transfer orbit on Falcon 9 without a Heavy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But what if you wanted to build a bigger platform, a bigger satellite, or an actual platform of transponders, maybe a modular one that you could plug in, you could use a satellite servicing vehicle to go add pieces to over time and modify and improve it? You know, you could launch something like that on Falcon Heavy. There's literally capabilities that will exist now that didn't exist before that could get people who design spacecraft to think differently, okay?
Yeah. The most useful thing
about the Falcon Heavy, or one of the most useful things, is it could carry a load of propellant for a spaceship.
Mm-hmm.
It can carry up a lot of propellant to low Earth orbit to fuel a spaceship that's going to go around the moon. So it would, you know, it would just be you could just dramatically make cheap what should be the cheapest part of a space mission, the propellant. And it's expensive now because we're launching it either in an incredibly expensive launch vehicle like SLS or more traditional smaller launchers. You know,
mm-hmm.
why not launch, you know, bulk material on a big dumb booster, like, even though it's not dumb at all, it's reusable, on the Falcon Heavy. But you're asking exactly the right questions, and that is one of the reasons why I think that commercial space is so exciting, is because it literally creates new industries. It creates waves, not just ripples, but waves of change that will propagate across other industries and other space applications, and things will happen that we didn't know could happen before.
Mm-hmm. I think they're talking about putting in a new engine in the Falcon 9. Is that just to get the number of launches per engine up, or is it actually going to increase the propulsion of the engine?
Okay, are you talking about the Merlin, or are you talking about using Raptor for the Falcon 9?
Merlin.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh.
I wasn't aware of them adding any engines. I think Elon's pretty thrilled that 27 engines worked all
together. Oh, not the 27 engines. It's the individual engine putting out, what was that? I thought he said five. Merlin 5? It's an upgrade of the engine, and he said it was the last one.
I can tell you the Falcon 9 Mark 5. Will be the sort of production Falcon that they're going to shift to, I believe, sometime this year, that will have in its basic, in terms of its design, it's going to be built to be reused. In other words, it's not being built to be reused once, it's built to being built to be reused at least 10 times. It'll have some added strength in certain places for landing stresses and things like that. And they may be indeed tweaking the Merlin somewhat for that version of the launch vehicle as well. I'm sure they already have tweaked it. I'm sure it's done. I'm sure it's working. But an additional engine, I'm not so sure about. I think it just may be a slightly different tweaked vehicle.
It's going to be a slight upgrade, in other words.
Right. But really, the main intrinsic goal of that is to sort of freeze the design for a long period of time and not make any more changes,
and to have it have the intrinsic ability to be reused a lot of times, whereas they're, you know, reusing them onesie twosies right now. But, you know, wasn't it cool that that Falcon Heavy was two reused side boosters? I mean, that was...
It's the paradigm shift. I'll let you go, and enjoyed it very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Marshall. Appreciate your call. And listeners, our line is available, 1-866-687-7221. And it's pretty clear we're not taking a break, Jim. So I want to thank our sponsors, which I have not mentioned yet, for being sponsors for our show today. So I do want to thank the Integrated Space Plan, the Space Foundation with their 34th Space Symposium coming up in April in Colorado, Orbital ATK, I want to thank them for their sponsorship as well, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and also Celestis. They've got a lot of flights coming up this year, and including they've got a flight planned for the moon. So great sponsors, everybody. Check out their banner ads, and we certainly appreciate it. And again, if you'd like to consider being a sponsor for the Space Show, contact me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we still have time for more of your email questions and certainly more of your phone calls. And again, the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. And I have a email question from Linda, who is in Phoenix. And Linda says, you haven't talked very much about the space exploration part of NASA and the space program. We understand that Falcon Heavy is a commercial launcher, but it is so much bigger. Could it be used for one of these planetary missions that NASA uses before SLS comes online, to possibly take a bigger payload to whatever the destination is and do it faster?
Yes.
Is that in the works?
In a rational world, yes.
So,
I'm not sure we live in a rational world, but I'm pretty sure we don't. Listen, the Falcon Heavy was an experiment, okay? It's an experiment that turned out really, really, really well. And we still learned something about the failure of two of the engines on the center core to relight, to be reused. But, you know, that's an improvement for next time. But NASA didn't know if it was going to work, and the Air Force didn't know if it was going to work. And so they can be forgiven for, you know, being a little skeptical and waiting until it actually did come off before they started planning to use it. But now that it's been demonstrated to work, I think you will see NASA's Launch Services Program look at it, work with it, you know, look at the data from this first flight, and, you know, get their arms around, you know, since it's flown successfully once, you know, taking a somewhat riskier payload and large payload and flying it on it. Again, hopefully the existence of a launch capability that's bigger and cheaper may cause scientists to design their spacecraft differently. In other words, again, instead of packing everything into every kilogram that they possibly can, maybe do it cheaper and quicker, but a little heavier, but that would allow more science to get done. You know, that's, you know, that it may seem heretical to some people, but it would actually be a good economic use of resources to actually pursue science faster. I do believe that whether it's missions like the Europa probe that Chairman Culberson in the House Appropriations Subcommittee wants to do, or other spacecraft to the outer planets, that a Falcon Heavy or a New Glenn when it comes online, or even a Vulcan when it comes online, could do a better job of launching than the current launch vehicles NASA uses. And even after SLS comes online, again, we're only going to be able to afford to launch SLS at most once a year. just because of the cost involved. You know, it will cost, you know, perhaps as much as $1 billion or $500 million to launch it again in the same year, and we're not going to have necessarily the manpower and fixed infrastructure set up to be able to launch it frequently. Of course, some of us would argue that that's a reason to not do SLS in the first place, because you want to have a faster cadence of launches. But leaving that aside for now, I think even after SLS is flying, I think they're going to want to use Falcon Heavy for cheaper missions, you know, as opposed to crewed missions. So I think there's all sorts of market opportunities for new launch vehicles that are cheaper per kilogram to launch. Absolutely.
You have another question from Alex in Houston, and he says, if a foreign company or another nation wanted to use Falcon Heavy, do they face ITAR constraints?
Well, if by use Falcon Heavy, I assume you mean just have it launch a payload for them.
Well, I think that's what Alex means. Email us if you mean something different.
Elon isn't going to be taking the Falcon Heavy over to another country and launching from there. That's not happening. It doesn't make sense economically, and probably doesn't make sense politically. I'm certain it doesn't make sense politically. But depending on which country it is, all sorts of countries around the world already pay Elon to launch their satellites on Falcon 9s from the Cape or from Vandenberg. So, and other countries launch on U.S. commercial launch vehicles all the time. So just as they launch on French launch vehicles from Kourou or Russian launch vehicles from Baikonur or what have you. So there is an international market in launch services. So absolutely, you know, Elon will want to sell launches of Falcon Heavy to international customers. Now, if you want to launch a death ray to space, I think the U.S. government might look askance at that, and I don't think Elon would try to sell that particular launch opportunity. So
Alex, probably no problem. You know, so just as there's no problem with a Falcon Heavy. Here's an interesting one for you. Jerome is in New York City, and he says, Jim, with your ear to the street that you have, has the Falcon Heavy sent any chills over to Ariane Space, to Russia, or to ULA?
Probably all of the above. Elon, SpaceX has single-handedly won back the majority of the world addressable launch market to the U.S. And it was not that many years ago that there were no commercial launches from the United States, and basically the entire market, global market, and satellite launches, you know, and there's some fraction of satellite launches that are only available to the country's own launch vehicle. In other words, you know, Russia is not going to launch military satellites on French launch vehicles, and India is not going to launch their satellites on other countries' launch vehicles, and et cetera, et cetera. So, and, you know, U.S. will not launch most military satellites on non-U.S. launch vehicles, et cetera. So there's some fraction of the market that is not available. But the addressable market, the fraction of the market that can be won in a competitive international way based on service and price and things like that, you know, 0% of it was in the U.S., and now over half of it is in the U.S., all thanks to the Falcon 9. So when SpaceX develops and demonstrates a new launch capability that's well beyond what anyone internationally can do, that surprises. I mean, now it doesn't surprise them as much, but it definitely sends a message. Now, I don't think people are suddenly going to love dual manifesting large geo commsats on a Falcon 9 Heavy any more than they did on the Ariane 5. And in fact, satellites grew to be too big to be dual manifested on the Ariane 5. But you could very well see some additional migration of international market to the U.S. because of Falcon Heavy. But again, you could also see other countries or other companies around the world decide that they could change how they use space to take advantage of the capability of the Falcon Heavy. Generally speaking, the satellite producers, though, are very conservative, and they want to always be able to use multiple launch vehicles for any one of their spacecraft. So they're perfectly happy having the choice amongst Falcon 9, Ariane 5 or 6, Proton, if it comes back, Sea Launch, et cetera. You know, if you design your spacecraft just for Falcon Heavy, you won't have any other launch vehicles that can launch it until New Glenn comes along, and then you'll have them as a backup competitor. So I think it's another message that the entrepreneurial approach that SpaceX has taken works, that the proof will be in the pudding of his being able to continue to demonstrate success, launch success with the Falcon Heavy. Again, I think that SpaceX has rightly put their priority on getting up their flight rate for the Falcon 9, because that's their bread and butter. That's where the international marketplace is. And they don't need to, you know, they fought, as Elon admitted, they almost killed Falcon Heavy 3 times over the last few years. Once it turned out they didn't need it, there were lots of arguments against continuing to complete it, because they were just going to focus on Falcon 9 and then BFR. Well, I'm glad they finished it, because it sent an earlier market signal that it is possible to do big rockets, it is possible to launch larger payloads, and do so very, very efficiently. I don't think it's ever going to be a huge moneymaker for SpaceX, because I don't think they're going to get, you know, they're going to focus on selling a lot of Falcon Heavies. But I think it will be successful. I think it will, you know, pay for itself. But what it really has taught them a lot about is engine interactions and multiple engines. And they solved that problem, and they pulled off the coolest stunt in history. And I think you're going to see in 2019, you're going to see a super grasshopper, a something from like a grasshopper from one of those 1950s science fiction movies that's been radiated by a nuclear meltdown or something. You're going to see a really big core stage flying in McGregor. And they may even have to fly it at the Cape. But you're going to see the beginnings of BFR actually take place and fly through the air in 2019. And, you know, when that happens, you know, given all the past history, I think people are going to really get frightened, because you're going to have a capability for launching literally, you know, hundreds of tons to orbit. And who knows what happens when that is pulled off.
The 2018, you know, we started the show going from a banner year of 2017 to where we are, and we're still in first quarter 2018. We've got roughly a little more than a third of the first quarter left. How do you see the rest of 2018 unfolding? Is it going to slow down? Is the pace going to be picked up to something spectacular? How do you see this year going?
I mean, you know, well, you know, not to pick on SpaceX, but I think, you know, they're forecast to launch perhaps 30 times this year, which is just, you know, I'm pretty sure is as many times as the U.S. as a whole has ever launched, you know, and much, many more than the Russians have launched recently. I think you're going to see Vector launch successfully this year. You're going to see Virgin Orbit launch towards the end of the year. You'll see Spaceship Two fly with powered flight early this year. You'll see Blue Origin launch New Shepard with a passenger by the end of the year, or with a spaceflight participant by the end of the year. There's just a tremendous number of things that are keyed up to happen. And, you know, you will see this broadening effect of more and more entrants into the marketplace, demonstrating that that same paradigm that worked for SpaceX worked for them. And you're going to see a level of dynamism and change that's just astonishing. So it's not just going to get faster, it's going to get broader. And I think it's going to be very, very exciting. Space is really, really, really cool again in a way that it arguably hasn't been since the 1960s and 70s. So, and that's a great accomplishment.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Doug from Southern California.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. Are you able to hear me okay?
You sound like you're in an echo chamber, but go ahead.
I can hear you fine, Doug.
Okay. I'm in a stairwell, so actually there is something to that. I wanted to sort of focus on the lander because I think it really makes a critical difference. During the Augustine Commission and otherwise, the discussion was that we couldn't afford a lander, but really specifically was that we couldn't afford a government lander such as the Altair. It cost them like $2 billion a year to develop that. When in natural reality, I think we need to look at what sort of lander could we get if we were to use the public-private approach, such as we use with COTS. Now, with COTS, I think it was about $400 million, the Falcon 9 was developed. And the Falcon 9 is, in my opinion, harder to develop than a lander because a launcher has to go through a lot more forces of launch, including Max-Q, and it's got a stage, whereas an in-space lander doesn't have those forces and doesn't necessarily need a stage. And also, if you take a look at that Zeus, the Zeus comes in a couple of varieties. One would be a drive from a Centaur, you know, existing Centaur stage. That was one variant of it. And then the second variant would be the ASUS space, modification of the ASUS upper stage, which has yet to be developed. If one were to start with the Centaur based, then it's an existing engine, the RL-10 engine. It's a highly flown upper stage.
You don't have to convince me. I agree with you. I think it's a great idea.
I agree, but I just don't hear. I don't think we're going to have a lunar COTS. I'm not hearing anything about a full-scale lunar lander, as I'm not anticipating it based upon what I'm hearing. So people can agree with lunar COTS and these things, but I don't see it happening, and I'm wondering why not.
Okay. First of all, most of the money is still being spent on Orion and SLS.
Right.
That program's not going away until it is completely supplanted by success elsewhere. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps after you have demonstrated Starliner and Dragon V2 and the companies associated with those vehicles have demonstrated that they have a capacity to expand their capability to serve the cislunar market, you might see at that point Orion be phased out. Okay? And likewise with SLS, okay? Some multiple vehicles that can launch 50 metric tons or more and they've demonstrated cryogenic propellant handling and transfer so that you can launch two of these things and transfer a bunch of propellant over to the upper stage of the primary launch to send a big ass payload to cislunar space. Now, those are all technical things that some people understood in 2009, but they were not chosen as the path forward because, one, they wouldn't keep the shuttle industry, the shuttle contractors alive, and two, they weren't proven yet. Now, I do believe, while it's not perhaps the size of the COTS program, that there actually is going to be an initiative in the budget both to buy lunar landing services from the small lander community and to start working on partnerships for larger landers with the industry as a whole. I don't know how much money is going to be proposed to go into that. I do not think that there's going to be money for a traditional lander to start up, because they don't have the money for it. So I think you're going to see some signs in the 2019 budget that comes out on, like, Tuesday of this week, that you'll begin to see some of these things happen, in at least proposed by the administration in the budget. Now, is that enough? Is that the right approach? Probably not fast enough. But again, we are where we are. You know, we're not going to let go of the current program until a whole lot of other things have happened and really proven themselves to show that we don't need the current program. And, you know, I personally would not prefer to have a big bloody fight, you know, with the traditional contractors this year. I would rather just make sure that there is some investment in partnerships for landers and other infrastructure so that the commercial sector has a seat at the table and has a chance to demonstrate itself. Because I know we'll prove ourselves. I know it will happen just because we've already done it. So,
Jim, you're speaking as though the only way we get a little bit more money is that we need to cancel the large government programs.
Like no, Ryan. Not a little more money. I'm saying a lot more money. You won't get a lot more money unless you cancel a major government program, part of the program record.
So COTS, commercial cargo, and commercial crew were all compatible with the large government program. It existed in the same budget.
I agree, but so, remember, they weren't developing and fielding a heavy lift launch vehicle yet. They were only doing Ares 1 and Orion.
Well, of course, you know, we freed up the money from the shuttle when it stopped flying.
I agree with you. What I'm saying is there will be some money for commercial partnerships. I think the desire on the part of a lot of people in Congress to actually get us back to the moon will lead to that result. There will be no credible way to spend money in a traditional path to get us to the moon, to the surface of the moon. So to the extent Congress wants a lunar surface program, they will absolutely embrace the commercial approach for going to the moon. The question is how much money is going to be there. Now, you know, the Congress just signed a budget deal, and the president signed off on it, that dramatically increases domestic spending, okay, in ways that, you know, would put drunken sailors to shame. So I don't know how much money NASA is going to get out of that. It could be that NASA's budget goes up by $1 billion. If it goes up by $1 billion, then we could have a very substantial COTS-like program for the moon. That would be wonderful.
I understand that from somebody at NASA Ames that there was perhaps an overestimate of how much commercial crew would cost. And if there could be some money taken from that and put into development of a lunar lander, we're talking, I believe, realistically, about $200 million to get a Zeus based on the Centaur.
Okay. Now, tell me whether or not ULA will be allowed to bid that by its parent companies.
Boeing, you're talking about.
And Lockheed.
Well, if the money's on the table, it would be interesting to see if you know, who would go after that money.
I agree. The question is not whether or not if the money's there. The question is whether or not the parents will actually allow the company to pursue the project.
Well, what I'm saying is in any public-private partnership, it's a competitive sort of thing. So if Boeing refuses to take the money, then would it be
No. Boeing, you're not understanding me. Boeing and Lockheed may decide they want to pursue their money themselves individually and tell their owned child, okay, that they totally control ULA to stay away from it. And say, ULA, you are a launch company. You are not to go work on a lunar lander. Now, the reality is, launch services from the moon absolutely fits ULA's master plan and their strategic purpose, and it absolutely generates a need for more launches from the Earth's surface of the Earth for propellant. Okay, so I am right there with you in supporting Zeus. My point is that I don't know whether Boeing and Lockheed will allow ULA to bid, because they may prefer to not have to compete against themselves.
We should find out.
Well, yes, and we should. And we should perhaps tell Lockheed and Boeing to stop screwing things up. But I'm just telling you, they're in charge. We aren't. ULA is in charge. Okay? So, so hopefully, Mastodon and ULA will be able to find a way to go forward. I think they have a concept. I think Blue Origin has a concept. I'm sure SpaceX has concepts. You know, all we need to do is get a few of these entrepreneurial teams working on this, and I think we'll have landers. I mean, big landers. And after they've flown a few times, especially if they're reusable, we'll be putting people on them.
Well, spread the word, because I really don't hear people talking that, in fact, we can't afford a full-size lander in the near term, and it wouldn't cost even $1 billion.
Well, I'm for you. I am for you. The issue is, there has been sort of a presumption, it was a false presumption, but there's been a presumption that NASA is investing a lot of money in commercial crew and in commercial cargo services as part of turning LEO over to commercial industry. A lot of companies have sort of presumed, and a lot of people in NASA sort of presumed, that meant that beyond Earth orbit was to be primarily carried out by traditional contractors and traditional programs. No one ever agreed to any such, Treaty of Westphalia or whatever that divided up the world that way or divided up the solar system that way. So the fact is that the private sector is already working on the moon, and the private sector can and will demonstrate capabilities in cislunar space that the government will absolutely need to buy. The question is how big a COTS-like program can we have to actually goose that and speed that up? I don't know. I am for more resources to be invested that way than in any traditional way. And frankly, I don't see there being enough dollars to even do paper studies a traditional way. So, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. You know, I just wish we had taken a different path in 2010. That's all.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Jim. Wish you well.
Thank you, Doug. Is that a dog I hear in the background, Jim?
Not here. It's at Doug's place.
Oh, I didn't know he had a dog. I should have asked him. I think I have time for one more question.
I do have an advertisement I want to make before the end. So
let me give you this one question, and then we'll
you can
do your ad. Karen in Albuquerque says, I'm reading that NASA has plans to turn the ISS over to commercial interest. What do you think about that? Do you think that's real?
That's one of those questions we could talk for 2 hours about. So here's what's going on. As a physical asset, the ISS will only probably only last another, perhaps till 2028 or 2030 or something like that. So it's going to stop functioning. The cost of maintaining it and improve and keeping it spaceworthy will go up over time. More importantly, NASA is currently spending roughly $4 billion operating and servicing the ISS.
A year, right?
A year, per year. And NASA absolutely needs to transfer some of that burden and have those funds freed up to pursue beyond Earth orbit activities. So the current plan was for, by all the partners, I believe, the Europeans, I think, have signed off but haven't finally signed off on continuing to operate the ISS through 2024. The real question is why did we build this thing and why are we using it in the first place? If you only look at ISS as a way to do life sciences research for Mars exploration and do some technology demonstrations for Mars exploration, then it's sort of a simple decision. How long can NASA afford to operate it before they have to basically splash it so that they can spend the money on beyond Earth orbit? I do not believe that's why Ronald Reagan built us the space station. I believe Ronald Reagan started the space station program so that we would have a permanent American presence in space. I know that because he said so. And I know that because we've said so in other ways many times over the last three decades. Now, even the Vice President, Vice President Pence, in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in October, said he wants to see a permanent American commercial presence in low Earth orbit. So now the question becomes, if we want a permanent American commercial presence in low Earth orbit, what we're talking about is commercial space stations. Well, then the question is how do we get from where we are with ISS to a future of commercial space stations, where NASA may continue to be a customer of some activities in low Earth orbit, but it doesn't have to spend $4 billion a year to do it? And that is the question that we are all trying to figure out. You know, how do we transition? How do we have a gapless transition in low Earth orbit? Instead of the huge long gap we've had between the space shuttle and the onset of commercial crew services, how do we have a gapless transition so that we continue to have Americans permanently living and working in space throughout the 2020s and into the 2030s and beyond? Just they won't all be astronauts and they won't all be on a government facility anymore. They'll be on privately developed and operated facilities, but that may still have the government as a customer, and the government even as a safety customer to decide whether or not the space stations are safe enough to use. You know, there can still be astronauts training and learning to adapt to microgravity and other things in low Earth orbit before they take missions to the moon or before they take missions to Mars. So that's the challenge, and that issue is being debated very actively in Washington right now. Different interests and different points of view have emerged. Some companies want to make sure that ISS is operated till at least 2028 so that it has a sufficient business base for them to develop and provide their services, whether it's crew or cargo. Some companies that are involved in private utilization of station already, like Nanorax and others, would like to see an earlier transition so that the government isn't competing with them with ISS as they develop these new commercial platforms. So it's a great question. It's very dynamic. It's absolutely going on right now as we speak, and you'll see articles about it. And if anyone tells you they know exactly how it's going to happen, they're lying to you because they don't know. They may know how they want it to happen. I have a lot of thoughts about this, but I'm not sure I know exactly how I want it to happen. So I'm actively working with a bunch of my client companies and members of the Commercial Space Flight Federation that care about this issue. And my vice president, Aaron Osterley, has written some great white papers on this. And, you know, we are all hard at work to try to make sure that we have a continuous American presence in space, that it not end, that it not have any gaps, and that we, in fact, grow America's presence in space so that within a decade or so we have dozens of Americans in space, not just a few. Because that would be successful. That would be a demonstration that space really is frontier and that we really are opening it for the American people.
Okay.
So, quick advertisement. So, you graciously acknowledged me as one of the co-founders of the Space Frontier Foundation. What some listeners may not know is that the Space Frontier Foundation a couple of years ago partnered with the National Space Society and Students for the Exploration and Development of Space and a few other organizations to create the Alliance for Space Development. And yes, it's allianceforspacedevelopment.com. And the Alliance puts on the March Storm every year, which is an opportunity for citizens to come to Washington. You know, you have to spend your own money, but come to Washington for a few days and get training in how to lobby your congressman and your senator and staff, and then actually go and directly lobby your representatives in government and talk about your vision for space and talk about specific issues like this gapless transition for ISS, about ultra-low-cost access to space, and the commercial development of cislunar space. So those are the agenda items that they're going to be pursuing this spring. It's going to be March 11th through March 15th. You don't have to come for the whole time, but you should at least come for the first few days. And you can get cheap flights to Washington from anywhere. And they always find a pretty low-cost hotel to stay in. And it's a lot of fun. I have gone and spoken to the March Stormers off and on many, many times over the last 20-plus years, and it always gives me a tremendous amount of energy to see people, citizens such as yourselves, to come to Washington and argue for why they want something in space, because, you know, you guys, you know, you may work in the space industry, but you're not just, you know, doing what you do or passionate just because of where you work. You know, I'm a dirty lobbyist. I'm someone who's registered with the Congress to lobby them on space issues. So for all they know, I'm only doing it because I'm being paid. Now, I think most congressional staffers who know me know that I'm in it for the dream. But the fact is that citizens always are more credible. Citizens coming in lobbying their government are not clearly doing it because that's what they want, because that's what they're committed to, because that's what their dream is. And it is so energizing to me and I think to everyone to see people come into Washington and lobby their members of Congress and lobby staffers and say, you know, this is the right thing to do. This is what we should do to get America into space. And yes, maybe things aren't all set up to do it this way right now, but you need to find a way to make it happen. You congressman or you senator or you staffer are in a position to make a difference. Please make a difference. And it happens every year. It'll be this March, as always. And the March Storm is a great opportunity, so please go to allianceforspacedevelopment.com. You can get all the details, and I hope to see you in Washington in a month.
Terrific. Glad you you got that out there. And we'd like to hear about your experiences when you go. So keep that in mind to get back to us for that. Anything else you'd like to leave us with today or any concluding thoughts?
Well, my last concluding thought will be a different advertisement. And it's people will think it's pretty silly. You know, I'm a pretty bipartisan person. Will you let me endorse a candidate for office, or is that not allowed on your show?
I don't typically do it because of the 501c3 status. So.
Well, but you're not doing it. You're not embracing it. I am, okay? So as a Republican lobbyist, I've actually given money to a Democrat who's running for Congress in Maryland. He's a young man. His name is Chris Hearsey, and he is he's running for Congress. I think it's the 6th district. I'm not sure the district number, but it's Western Maryland. He is a pro-business Democrat. He used to work as a counsel for Bigelow Aerospace. He has a long history in the space policy and the space law community. He's young, he's energetic, and he's taking the risk and his own ego at risk and running for Congress. And I think that's a great thing to do. And, of course, I don't have his website in front of me, but I'm sure you can find out. You just Google around for Chris Hearsey, and you guys should send him a few bucks to help him out. If he gets in, there's a very good chance he could win the primary and then would definitely win election. We'll have a really hardcore pro-space cadet in there in the U.S. House of Representatives fighting for us, and that's a good thing. So that's my last comment. And by the way, David, I cannot say how much I enjoy these calls and these appearances on your show. I want to try to do them more often. I'll probably send you an email in a month saying, when can I come back? When can I come back? Because you are really the chronicler of the new space age. You are the person who is, hearing the stories and telling the stories as people did thousands of years ago around campfires. You're doing it over the internet and the phone and tape recording that is literally going to pass on the oral history of how we did this incredible thing. And our community owes you a great debt of gratitude. And please, people, do what you can to support David's show. It's fantastic.
Thank you. And when I start opening up second quarter dates, I'll send you a note, and maybe you can come on toward the middle or toward the end of the second quarter for an update.
That'd be great.
Okay. Jim, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you soon. Listeners, that's it. Remember, no show tomorrow, and we're back Tuesday. All of that is on the upcoming show menu, and the website newsletter will be posted in the near future. Everybody have a great week. Keep looking up. Goodbye from Jim Muncy, myself, and The Space Show.